What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Oh my word. That's pretty hard saying, isn't it? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Let's just cut to this chase. Marriage is hugely controversial. It's hugely controversial today, and unfortunately it's also becoming highly politicized. So it's controversial, it's politicized. And I'm in a position, as I mentioned last week, I'm in a position where I'm called upon to marry people in the parish at any given moment. And whenever I do that, you're speaking to at least 200 people. Some will be Christians, many won't be. Some will be divorced, others will be in civil partnerships. Some will be remarried, perhaps more than once. Others will just be sleeping around, having no intention of getting married. Others will be married and having affairs. And there you have this couple in front of you getting married, and everybody is thinking about their marriage. Those who are not married and are single will be thinking, will I ever get married? Will I ever find the one person that's made for me? That's what we're thinking as they look at this couple getting married. Those who are married, perhaps for years, will be thinking about their marriage. And they'll be thinking, ooh, it's been painful. Others who are divorced will be thinking of their previous husbands and their previous wives as they look at this couple getting married, and they'll be thinking about them. And then they'll be thinking about their children that they had with their previous husbands and wives, and perhaps they'll feel sadness there because they've lost touch with them. So though it's a very happy occasion, everybody in the congregation is going to be moved one way or the other as they watch this couple getting married. Now, no matter, speaking to that situation, you can see how politicized it is, how controversial it is. No matter how gentle I am and encouraging I am, I'm bound to offend somebody. But as you offend some people, you'll be encouraging others. So, you know, that's just the situation we're in, isn't it? We're in a unique cultural situation today. I say unique cultural situation because for the first time ever, the British government has somehow got into its head that it has the authority by a show of hands in Parliament that they have the authority to change the definition of marriage. Now, you're going to stop, I think, before I'm going to talk about what marriage is. But before we ever start that, let's just ask us, how on earth have we as a culture got ourselves into the position where it's plausible in the minds of many people that the government can, by a vote of show of hands, change something like the institution of marriage, something that they didn't even invent? How have we got to this situation? What's happened to our culture that we're now in this cultural situation where we have the government thinking that it can do this? Well, I'm going to introduce you a term. It's not my term. It was invented by Peter Berger, a sociologist. And he said, listen, you've got to understand that cultures develop plausibility structure. Plausibility structure. Now, that sounds complicated. It's not complicated. It's quite simple. He says every culture will regard certain things as being rational and normal and plausible. That happens in every culture. For example, if you went to ancient Rome, it was quite normal, plausible, that you, for entertainment, you'd watch people kill themselves. That was normal. That was a plausibility structure that allowed that society to do that. And nobody thought anything of it. That was like, yeah, that's what you do. In those cultures, that was a plausibility structure. that everybody thought was a reasonable way to behave. If you go to the Amazon jungles, I suppose you could meet cannibalistic societies where it's plausible, it's normal to eat your enemies. And that's just how it is. There's nothing strange about that. That's just how you live. That's what you do to your enemies. You eat them. In our culture, it's plausible and uncontroversial and normal for abortion to be taking hold. So the most dangerous place for a person today in Western societies is the mother's womb. That's just normal. Not controversial, really. That's just it. Now, certain things are implausible in certain cultures. For example, in Buddhist cultures, it's implausible. It's not rational to help the poor. You don't want to do that. You don't want to help the poor because the poor are suffering because of their bad karma and their previous lives. So if you help them, you're actually interfering with that karma business. And so it's not plausible. It's not rational. It's not normal to help the poor. That's just their worldview. So every culture, you see, develops worldviews. They have a web of assumptions, a web of beliefs, a web of convictions, and that forms the way they are. Now, we've got ourselves into this unique cultural moment. The roots of it go back deep, far. They go back to the, late 19th century. We had very rational, very sort of radical philosophers. They were regarded as radical then. They're regarded normal now. They basically taught, people like Nietzsche basically taught, listen, guys, you've got to understand, you've come from nowhere and you're going nowhere. That was radical at the time. Everybody believes that now. That's very plausible. You've come from nowhere and you're going nowhere. Okay. Now, when Nietzsche was first teaching that, people were horrified. That's terrible. Huh? Now it's normal. Everybody believes that. So if you've got no creator at the beginning and no judge at the end, it's now rational, now makes sense, doesn't it? Therefore, says Nietzsche, listen, it's like children. We've never done this, by the way, but you know when your parents sometimes go on holiday and they leave the children at home? Very foolish. Very foolish. We've never done it. Because, you know, when the parents are away and the children are at home, things become plausible. It's plausible to trash the house because their parents are gone, you see. And so Nietzsche was basically saying, look, the parents have gone. We're in charge of the house. It's party time. So you can make up your own meaning. You can do whatever you like. Now, that's the cultural air as we live in. And, of course, in this context, of course you can redefine marriage. There's no creator, there's no judge. Do what you like with it. It doesn't have to be gay marriage. Polygamy is very plausible in Saudi Arabia. That's normal. No questions asked. Normal. Seven wives? No problem. So we could, if what society wanted, in this plausibility structures that we've got now, we can redefine marriage not to include gays. We could redefine marriage to include polyamory. What's that, you say? Polyamory? It's catching hold in America, you know. Polyamory is where groups of people, men and women, live together, and they share their sexual favors amongst each other, and together they raise the children. Polyamory. Polyandry, why not? Why not? Just redefine marriage, put it to the vote. Wives can marry more than one husband. Many of them, why not? You can do anything, you see. And of course, this was actually, this way of thinking was actually articulated by the National Coalition of Gay Organizations, which demanded in 1972, all that long time ago, says the National Coalition of Gay Organizations demanded repeal of all legislative provisions that restrict the sex or number of persons entering into a marriage union. And the extension of legal benefits to all persons who cohabit, regardless of sex or numbers. That's plausible, isn't it? That's a plausibility structure now. Why not? Why shouldn't you do this? Just put it to the vote, get it through Parliament, and bingo, there we are. And now, as we listen, now all these questions, you see, are being raised now in a very aggressive way. In fact, you are seen as implausible and irrational if you don't hold on to it. So before you're going to, you see, the temptation is this: these arguments are so plausible and so rational and so obvious that to stand against it, you're regarded as a freak So if we're not going to be swept away by this huge, massive tide, we've got to get certain things very carefully in our mind. And we're going to look briefly at what Jesus says about marriage in Mark chapter 10. And the first thing that he says about marriage is that marriage is a covenantal relationship. Learn that word, a covenantal relationship. Marriage is a covenant. Now, let me explain that. Here is Jesus, and as Roy said, he's just gone from Capernaum, and he's crossed over the Jordan into the region of Judea. Now, why is Mark giving us that information? Why has he put that there? Well, actually, it's hugely relevant, because by crossing by going into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, Jesus has entered now into the region controlled by that tyrant, Herod, the Tetrarch of Galilee. Okay, so Jesus is in hostile territory. And Herod had the tendency to redefine marriage. Because Herod had redefined marriage so that he could enter into a relationship with Herodias, his brother's wife. And John the Baptist had sort of raised objections to that. He said, excuse me, don't make too fine a point of it, but it's not lawful. What you're doing, no, don't do it. Well, he lost his head. Okay? And John the Baptist happened to be Jesus' cousin. So he's crossed over into the territory of Herod the Tetrarch. Huge crowds are following Jesus as well as his enemies. And they've seized upon this moment to just raise a question. Rabbi, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Silence. This has become highly politicized. This has become highly controversial. Herod's agents are in the crowd, and they're listening to what this rabbi has got to say, because whatever he says is going to go straight back to Herod, who's just killed Jesus' first cousin. So you can imagine the scene. In the silence, Jesus responds with another question. He says, what did Moses command you? They immediately go back to Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy chapter 4, where Moses allowed divorce. Oh, yes, says Jesus, I know all about Deuteronomy 24, but let's go further back. What else did Moses teach? Well, from the very beginning, Moses wrote, God made them male and female, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two will become one, so they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. So let's go back to the original teaching. Lest Moses allow divorce because of the hardness of your heart, but from the beginning, it was not so. From the beginning, it was a covenantal, sacred, binding, lifelong commitment between two people of the opposite sex to the exclusion of everybody else. That's what it was like at the beginning. You say to me, well, where'd you get that in the text? I said, well, read the text. Look at what Jesus says. First of all, he says, a man shall leave his father and mother. Well, yeah, what's that mean? What that means is, a man, when he enters into marriage, is to downgrade, and lessen all other emotional bonds and attachments. To downgrade them, to lessen them. Because as you know, in the ancient Near East, and in many parts of the ancient Near East today, a man is defined by his family. You would have been defined not by what you do, but the family that you come from. I mean, we don't do that so much anymore. I mean, we define people by, you know, what job do you do? That's why as soon as you meet somebody, you're desperate to say, well, what do you do for a living? Because we want to define them. Oh, well, that's 30,000 a year. You know, we've nailed them. We put them in a box. That's the job. Okay, you're about that. You know, that's where you're on the social scale. Because it defines us. Now, in the ancient Near East, it wasn't It wasn't your job that defined you. It was your family that defined you. It was your tribe. So people would say, well, who are your parents? What's your tribe? Where do you come from? What's your home like? And so a man's family was hugely significant to him, hugely important, because it was his emotional, the emotional vortex of his life, the emotional center of his life was his family, his parents, and his tribe. Now, what Jesus is saying, no, a man has got to leave that. Leave. What's that word leave bring to mind? Leave. It's an exodus. Exodus. To leave. Go out from, separate yourself from. This is a call like Abraham received. Abraham, leave what? Your country, your father's house, and your kindred. Leave them all behind. Why? Abraham, you have to leave, you have to go to Exodus, you've got to go out, because I'm going to change you from Abraham into Abraham. I'm going to completely redefine you. I'm going to reconstitute you. Israel, enslaved people in Egypt, leave Egypt, leave behind the Egyptians, leave the garlic, leave the leeks, leave all the food, leave it all, because you're going to be transformed from a slave people into a freedom loving nation. So you have to leave, cut yourself off from all that is behind. So this is what's happening here when Jesus says that a man shall leave his family, cut himself off from all his emotional attachments that bound him in the past, and he's now to cleave to his wife. In other words, his wife is now going to become the emotional center of his life. Now, let me just have a word to parents here, because this is very, very difficult to do, very difficult. Some children never, ever manage to leave their parents. Never. And they fail to do it for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes parents, and if you're a parent who've got married children, please don't interfere in your children's marriages. Don't do that. Don't phone up all the time giving advice when they haven't asked it for advice. Get out of the marriage. Get your mucky paws off it. Your son has left. Your daughter has left. They're no longer part of your family. They've left. They've gone out and formed a new unit. Now, children also find this very, very difficult to do. So it's not just the parents. Children find it difficult to do, to leave their family behind. Because when a man and a woman, when young children first get married, they come into the marriage with all sorts of weird ideas. Weird ideas. I'll give you an example. You know, Caroline, you should understand about Caroline. She comes from a normal, respectable family. And she married me. And, she had certain ideas about how men should behave, husbands. I mean, she thought, I don't know where she got this idea from, she thought that men, the husband, should be in charge of the maintenance of the car. Nobody ever told me that. Now, where did she get that idea from? Well, she got it from her dad. Her dad loved cars. Every 4 years, change the car, beautiful car, love cars. Her brother used to buy cars, take them apart, and put them all together again. So she thought that's what men did. He said, well, she married me. She married, and we were living in Philadelphia at the time, and we had to buy the second-hand car, and it was winter. And because it was winter in Philadelphia, it had snow tires on, which are big, chunky things to grip the snow. And, of course, that was in the winter. Then, of course, in Philadelphia, it changes into the summer. It's 92-degree heat. And Caroline thought that I should change the tires on the car. Well, actually, I quite like the roaring sound the wheels make as you drive around town. And also, I like the fact that, you know, because it was so hot, the tarmac used to melt. It left a trail, you know. These chunky tires left a trail, and I thought, well, people could, they always knew where I was, because I was the only one in Philadelphia driving around. She was embarrassed by this. Carol was embarrassed because it kind of showed up that she married a complete nutter, you know. So we had to have a lot of sit-down chats. About what my duties as a husband should be. Now, my friends, let me tell you this. That was painful. It felt like a war zone. This is only a tiny little thing of who was responsible for the car. Now, when you get married, you've got to renegotiate everything. Because things were done in my family that weren't done in her family. And so when these two people come together, you've got to start from scratch. And very often children don't want to. I mean, I just wanted to be who I was. Why should I change? I don't like change. I find it very difficult to change. It's challenging. And these talks, Karen very patiently sit me down and explain certain things very clearly to me. And it was painful. As I said, it becomes a war zone. And the other thing you've got to do, and why it's so difficult, is you've really got to trust, really trust, your husband or your wife. Because you're burying your soul. And what happens if Caroline picks up the phone to her parents and says, "Mom, Dad, I married this absolute nutter. Look what he does about the car. You know the car? He does what? You know?" And then she's got all her extended family. They're all involved now. So I found out my family saying, "Mom, Dad, I married this woman. She's crazy." You know? And then I've got that. And before you know it, World War III is breaking out. You see. Now Jesus says, no. When a man gets married, he's to leave his father and mother. And you're going to have to be reconfigured into something else. This is a new family taking shape here. Things are going to be done differently. It's not going to be the same. You're going to leave your father and mother, and you're going to cleave to your wife. Now that brings us to the second thing. Not only is marriage a covenantal relationship where you sever all other relationships and your wife becomes the emotional vortex of your life, it also marriage is the beginning together of opposites. It's the bringing together of husband on the one hand and wife on the other. Now, this is what Jesus is appealing to. This is what Jesus mentions when he's asked about divorce. They said, "Is it lawful?" And Jesus says, "Well, what's it like from the beginning? What was it like at the dawn of time?" Now, bear in mind this, because sometimes when you listen to the debates happening on the radio, on the TV, what you sometimes get the impression was that Bronze Age man or Neolithic man was there in his cave, and he said, listen, we've got to get this marriage thing under control. There are all these other types running around. We've got to exclude them. So we're going to define marriage in this, as if prehistoric man or very early man came up with what marriage is. She said, no, it wasn't like that. At the dawn of creation, there was male and there was female. This is a natural institution that arises out of the created order. Jesus is saying, look, folks, just let nature teach you. Look at nature. What does the created order say? Because inbuilt into the created order, there is a moral structure that was there from the very beginning. Because God created male and female. Therefore, a man shall cleave to his wife. The two, male, female, will become one. The two will become one flesh. He mentions that twice. So I guess it's important to him. Now look at this text carefully. Moses says that God created man in his own image. Okay, they've got singularity. They've got man. Out of this man, God divided humanity into two halves. Male on the one hand, female on the other. In a very simple way, that's what sex means, isn't it? Sex. The word, those letters, S-E, mean to sever. You segregate. You segregate. You use secateurs to divide. You sever things. You cut them in half. So sex is the separation of humanity into two halves. And therefore, God created them like this from the unity. He created two distinct beings. And then they come together in one flesh. What does that mean? The two will become one. Well, you're a sophisticated audience. It's obvious, isn't it? There's a complementarity to men and women. You know, they fit, guys, okay? It just works. There's, the way that God's made them, it kind of fits. That's what it means, to become one flesh. Is that all it means? Is it just a physical thing? Well, I don't think so. When Jesus talks about being made in the image of God, that includes women, male and female, created them in the image of God. So men and women are created physical beings, and when in marriage, they become one flesh. But that means not just physically. Not just a physical thing. That means they're to become one flesh psychologically. One flesh spiritually, one flesh emotionally, and economists will also tell us that actually men and women are economic units of production, so they should also become one flesh economically. Now, think about the implications of this, because the implications of this are huge. This means, ladies and gentlemen, parents, listen to this, because this is what you're going to have to teach your children. This means that it rules sex out before marriage. You got that? No sex before marriage. Sex happens within marriage. Think about it. Think about the pain that's caused when this isn't followed. Because what happens is, people say to me, oh, well, you know, I met this girl at this party, and, you know, whew, I really fancied her. And sex is a natural drive, and I'm a physical being, and she's a physical being, so, well, why not? Why not? But why not? Let me tell you why not. Because what you're doing is, what you're saying, what the person is saying is, listen, you know, I really fancy your body. So I'd quite like, you know, to have sex. But actually, all this other stuff, I don't want to become psychologically dependent on you. I don't want any way to become economically responsible for you. I just want your body, you see. I don't want you. Can I just have your body? We'll have a nice time for a few hours, and then in the morning, it's bye-bye. Because I don't want you, I don't want your problems, I don't want your spiritual states, I don't want you making my life complicated with all your emotional needs. I just want your body, and I don't want you. Ouch! That hurts. That can cause real pain. People have committed suicide because of that. It causes real pain to feel that level of rejection. Because what the person says, look, I became naked in front of you. Your gaze penetrated who I was. I became totally exposed, and you're saying to me that you don't really want me, you just want my body. But I'm not just a body, I'm other things too. And it hurts, doesn't it? That's painful. Of course it's painful. Because you're doing violence to what sex is. You're misusing it. It's not from the beginning, it was not so, says Jesus. Now, let me give you another example. I hope you're not too offended by this, but a few years ago, Cal and I, we had one of these city breaks, you know. It's good. Nice. We decided to go to Amsterdam to see the Rijksmuseum. Unfortunately, we didn't know it was going to be completely, you know, half the things weren't on show because it's being redone. So we're going to have to go again because now it's all there. We saw the Night Watch, and that was about it, because everything else was not there. So we'll have to go again. But on the way to the Rijksmuseum, you saw these very lovely ladies dressed in bikinis sitting behind windows. Very attractive. And I tried to avert my eyes. You know, I'm a vicar, after all. But there were these signs in the windows that said, please remember that this is a commercial transaction. Why would you have to remember that? Because some guys would get confused. Some guys obviously, this was obviously causing enough of a problem there to remind everybody. Some guys got went into those prostitutes and fell in love with them. And then they wanted a relationship with them. And these women have to say, look, it's money I want. I don't want you, but I loved you. No, go away. It was 10 minutes. That was it. What more do you want? Get out. Painful. Hurts. Ouch. In the beginning, it was not so. Have some integrity, Jesus is saying. When you come together physically, it's not just your bodies, it's the whole of you. And that can only be done within the covenantal relationship of marriage. Now, is that hard? Yeah, I think if you went down and preached that in Nutswood, some people would find that very difficult. I think it's obvious, though. I just have to mention it. People go, yeah, that's how it works. I can see that's obvious. That's in the order of creation. That's just the way it is. Now, there's one last thing, and I'll finish on this. Not only is marriage therefore a covenantal relationship where the wife becomes the emotional center of your life, and you, all other relationships fall to one side. Not only is marriage the union of two separate beings, husband and wife, to create a one flesh union with all that means, this is also something that God does. Now, I find this astonishing because this is what Jesus mentions. Jesus quotes Moses, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so they're no longer two but one. And then Jesus answers. Jesus puts this in. He then says, therefore what God has joined together. Oh, my word. God is doing this. God is bringing together that man and that woman. God is doing it. And my friends, when God does something, believe me, he does a good job. When God does something, he does it well. And when God brings the husband and the wife together, he brings them deeply together, profoundly together. It's God's doing. He's doing it. So the implications of this are huge, because this means that anybody who's, you don't have to be a Christian to get married now, you see. God is interested in marriage. Now, this marriage can happen in a church. That's great. It can happen in a registrar's office. That's great. It can happen on the beach. That's great. It can happen in a pub. That's great. It doesn't matter where it happens. When these vows are taken, God is doing it. Now, this is why, I think, theologically speaking, why the government's proposals are complete and utter nonsense. Because what the government wants to do was to sever this one entity and say, well, look, let's have religious marriage and secular marriage. Where'd you get that idea from? How can you have it? What they're trying to say is, listen, God is interested in religious marriage. You religious people have your religious marriage. That's what God's interested in. And then we'll have this other marriage. No, it doesn't work like that. God is interested in all marriages. Because God is deeply involved in marriage. Because this is the gift of God in creation, as the House of Bishops' recent report has said. This is the gift of God in creation and applies to everybody. Not just to religious people. Now, let's just think about this. If God is doing this, this means that marriage is bigger than your feelings. Okay? Marriage is bigger than your feelings. Now, again, this is so difficult because people say, well, look, it works like this. There isn't a God. I'm come from nowhere. I'm going nowhere. And Cupid's arrow. And remember, Cupid is blind, right? So Cupid has just gone ding with his bow. And, I love you. I've got these feelings now. It's not, I can't help it. Can't help, don't blame me. I've just got these feelings. And I guess you've got these feelings for me. So as we've all got these feelings, let's get married. Because that's what I feel. Oh, really? That's great. I mean, that's great. I hope you've got feelings. I hope the people I marry have got feelings for each other. But believe me, when you're negotiating tires, and your marriage is turning into a war zone, which it can be, it can do, those feelings will quickly disappear. You'll wake up one morning and you'll look at your wife and say, guess what? My feelings have gone. Because I don't want to change. I want to remain exactly how I am. And I find change difficult. So if you're making these demands on me now, I'm sorry, darling, but my feelings, there's somebody else. I've now got feelings for her. There's three people. So if your marriage is going to be grounded on your feelings because you can't help it, when your feelings go, does that mean the marriage disappears? Yes, people would say. No, says Jesus. In the beginning, it was not so. But there's another thing, because it's feelings actually undermine marriage. Because think about this. If marriage is just about your feelings, why get married at all? I remember I wasn't a very good youth minister. It's a very unique job and very special people have to do it. I was terrible. But I remember speaking to my youth group in London and this girl, 17 years old, saying, well, what's all this marriage business? Why can't I just move in? Because marriage is about love, right? Marriage is about love. And I love this person. So I'm just going to move in with it. And that's the important thing, Nigel, is the feelings. So actually feelings undermine marriage because you don't need marriage if you've got the feelings. Why get married? Now, when you come to the marriage service itself, and sometimes I've had people saying, you know, can I make up my own marriage vows? I always say no. Because what they want to say, and it's lovely and sentimental, romantic and nice, but what they want to say is, oh, darling, I love you, so beautiful, you're the best thing in my life, I can't believe I lived without you. It's all about them. But if you listen to the vows, it says nothing about feelings. Listen to this. I asked the couple, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife? To live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony. Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor and keep her in sickness and in health? And forsaking all others, doesn't matter what your feelings are, you're forsaking all others, keep thee only unto her so long as ye both shall live. Answer, I will. Second set. I, N, take thee, N, to my wedded wife, to have and to hold, from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, to love and to cherish, till death us do part, according to God's holy law, and thereto I plight thee my troth. That's what I'm committing myself to. My feelings may go up and down, round and round, sideways, up and down. It's irrelevant. My feelings don't really matter. What matters is it's my vows, it's my words that are bringing this new relationship into existence. This is a bulwark against the ravages of time, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health. Darling, I don't care what's going to happen to us. I don't care if we're rich or poor, or healthy, sick. No matter what happens, I'm going to be your husband till the day you die. And my feelings will come and go. But that is what I'm pledging myself to. And that's what brings the marriage into existence. You know, I don't think when Jesus was on the cross, I should just mention Jesus on the cross briefly. When Jesus was on the cross, dying by inches, I don't think he sat there, he wasn't sitting there, I don't think it was nailed there thinking, oh, I really fancy these people in front of me. They're great. I don't think that was going through his mind. I think what is going through his mind, these are sinners. And I need to rescue them. And I'm going to save them by loving them. And my love is going to be expressed not in my feelings, but by the fact I'm being nailed to the cross for them. And there you have the perfect example of a loving husband who died to save his wife, the church. Amen.